the retreat was canceled. In an email chain between Liesl, another board member, and Jessica, Jessica admitted the cancellation of the retreat was her fault. Quote, I am willing to take full responsibility for the retreat not happening as planned, that I am no longer as healthy or functional as when this project began, and be accountable for taking on too much and unable to follow through with the full vision. However, she pushed back on them on several points. Quote, I will not agree to things that are not truth, unquote. Jessica defended herself, saying that she did not prevent the transfer of ownership to the community, suggesting that they form a structure to buy the whole property completely as a collective. And she suggested that they could buy a parcel of the existing Birchtown land, which she assessed at $80,000.
She said if she removed the mortgage co-signers, she could lose the property entirely.
This email was followed by multiple requests from Liesl and the others to take Liesl's husband off the mortgage and for their own refunds. In fact, multiple people have asked for refunds from Jessica, such as the YWCA of Halifax. In July 2022, they asked for their $5,000 to be returned so that it could go towards funding a retreat for their Black Staff Caucus, as originally planned. There was no response.
I don't really know where it went or if it went towards the retreat or what really happened.
People really bought into this and believed in this and donated money that they made a choice between sometimes buying groceries for that week to donate money and not just BIPOC folks.
And what I'm hearing from these frustrated donors is that Jessica is still living in the house on the Birchtown Retreat property.
They are living there. They even specified that in their email. They're living in the one house, and I believe her mother is living in the other house.
The sale of the Biscuit Eater went through, and Jessica and her husband no longer own the cafe. I spoke to many, many more people for this story than you've heard from. But they didn't want to go on the record, all for the same reason. They were afraid that Jessica Hepburn would say they're racist. According to my sources, Jessica has privately and publicly called out people for discriminating against people of color, often when she's called out first.
So yes, that is definitely a pattern that has been used. I do think that, yes, that is the mode of operation that they have used in the past. I know a few persons that way that she's described them as racist, and then that person has just disappeared or kept quiet because they're afraid. They're afraid of retribution, you know, in the past too, even recently.
I had sent Jessica several messages seeking to get her side. I wanted to know if she really did live at the house. But she only responded with an email asking me if I knew how to participate in a calling in process and a few other details about her family that I won't share here. So I tried calling her.
Hi, you reached the cell phone for Jessica Hepburn. I hope you are well and wonderful, and I'm sorry I'm not available to take your call. Please leave me a message.
She didn't answer. But we needed to know for sure if she was still living in that house, a house that by now was supposed to be hosting wellness retreats for BIPOC folk. And I wanted to give her every chance to respond to all the allegations you've heard. So we sent a freelance journalist.
Hi, I'm looking for Jessica.
Can I tell who's calling?
Yeah. Jessica's husband answered the door.
A reporter, and I'm just seeing if she's interested in speaking about the property and the plans for the retreat that she was going to build here.
Not at this time, no.
No, she's not here. Okay. Is she here, though?
I don't feel comfortable giving you that information. It's kind of unsettling that you would just show up regarding this issue when there are other avenues to continue reaching out.
Later, we sent her a full list of questions about the allegations you've heard in this episode. She responded in a lengthy email denying the allegations that the cancellation of the retreat was ever intentional or that she ever attacked anyone or called them racist. She says her former organizers refused to use legal methods for a resolution and have begun escalating attacks on her character. However, she does admit to taking on more than she was capable while also going through some personal struggles. And she admits she was a stressful person to be around. She claims that she has now given refunds to everyone who reached out and requested one, a total of 6 people. However, she goes on to say that not everyone wants a refund. Just before publication, I did receive confirmation
that some people have started to receive refunds for their memberships. Some of the people who worked with Jessica to create the Birchtown Retreat say that they believe she never meant for things to turn out this way. They say that she had big dreams and just ended up in over her head with very little money to make the project actually work. And that could be true, but there are others who think it went a little differently, like Lauren.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at it, I think so. Just the way it happened, I'm like, it just felt too calculated. I'm like, maybe it wasn't. Part of me also was like, you know, maybe somehow it's not fraudulent, but I just feel like it is, though, when I look at the facts. I don't know. From what I know, I feel like it was, like, premeditated. Just from the patterns and the experiences that people have shared with me, it feels really pessimistic and, like, yucky to think that it's, like, premeditated, but it's just the feeling that I have. Yeah.
In reporting this story, I had worries about portraying racialized people and community organizing in a negative light, because initiatives like Birchtown and other projects which try to meet the needs of marginalized communities, well, they're really important, and they often rely on outside funding and the goodwill of outsiders. But making sure those promises are kept is also important, and so are the stories of the many people who came forward to me, feeling they had been stolen from or deceived. Lauren tells me that she's felt harmed and exploited by her participation in this whole project, and she never realized how that harm could be caused by someone within her own community. It's a lesson she wants to speak out on.
And, you know, people of color can be racist to other people of color. Like, another reason why I'm speaking out about this is because, like, there's this misconception in our communities that a person of color can't be racist to another person of color. Like, yes, we can be. It was tokenizing, and we're unsure if that's okay to say because it was a black woman who was doing it. But the thing is that we can be tokenized by our own communities, and we can be exploited by our own communities.
Lauren says she's ready to move forward and create the beautiful space her community deserves.
Lots of us just want, like, some kind of accountability or, like, just to get it out there to move forward and, like, hopefully pick up this project with, like, the right folks. Just because it's really heartbreaking that community didn't get this beautiful thing that they were promised. Like, it's really sad.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter @CanadaLand. Our website is canadaland.com. This episode was reported by Cherie Suturin. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Zia Jones, senior editor at Extra Magazine. Hello.
Hello, Jesse.
On the show today, Justified. The Laurentian consensus is in, and Justin Trudeau is off the hook for invoking the Emergency Act. Welcome to Shortcuts, Zia, where we talk about the news.
I love talking, so thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
After careful reflection, I have concluded that the very high threshold required for the invocation of the act was met. I do not come to this conclusion easily, as I do not consider the factual basis for it to be overwhelming. Reasonable and informed people could reach a different conclusion than the one I have arrived at.
Wow. It was okay for the Prime Minister to invoke the Emergency Act, I guess. No, he concluded. It was reasonable. I've concluded that it was okay. He met the threshold. I didn't come to this conclusion easily because the factual basis for it was not overwhelming. There wasn't a ton of facts to base this on. And reasonable people could have come to the opposite conclusion. If the Prime Minister had not done that, that would have been totally fine too. Zia, it's not much of a win, but it is a win. It is a win for the Prime Minister.
Like, on a technicality, it's like, you weren't wrong, but you could have been, but you weren't really. It's like when somebody's apologizing to you and they kind of say sorry, but they don't really. And you're like, okay, I guess we'll go with it.
Look, there was tons of nuance. It sounded like he was just like, all right. Ultimately, all the facts, all the nuance, it's going to come out with a win or a loss for the Prime Minister. And it was a win. And that means it was a loss for Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. Did he take the L? Zia, he did not.
This was an emergency that Justin Trudeau created. By attacking his own population, he poured more gasoline on the fire with nasty insults, jabbing his finger in the faces of his own citizens, something that even today's report acknowledged contributed to the length and the intensity of the protest.
Okay, so this is like Politician 101, where you know, journalists are like, okay, dude, you lost. What do you have to say? And he's like, what do you mean I lost? Look right here on page 433. This report agrees with me entirely. The Prime Minister was needlessly divisive, which it does say. It says that it was a bad idea for Trudeau to call all of the protesters a fringe minority. And Pierre Poilievre seized on that to kind of act like, maybe I didn't lose. Maybe this actually confirms everything that I've been saying from this. Dude, you lost. You lost.
The thing about being a reactionary is you don't actually really need to base what you're saying and doing in reason a lot of time. You can just take the small little kernel and then spin it so that what you want to be true is true.
Yeah. I'll take the L. You know, I thought this was overreach. I don't really have much invested in it as the leader of the Conservatives do. It wasn't like I was like gambling that I thought this would go the way that I wanted it to go. This is how tortured my position is. I agree with people who say, well, what could Trudeau have done? He had to do something. And the way that I would have liked this to have gone is, I guess I'm glad that they cleared that and they had to clear it out of downtown Ottawa. And then I would like to have seen him told that it was the wrong thing to do, because I'm really concerned about what that's going to mean going forward. That's how I would have liked it to go. It didn't go that way. I'll take the L. How did Trudeau take the win? Was this a humble response? Was this a prime minister who took the recommendations and the criticism that was included in this report gracefully? Or did he do a victory lap?
I believe he did say, you're right, I shouldn't have been so mean.
Yes. And it's interesting that he needed this report to say, I should have phrased that differently.
Yeah.
It's never a good idea, I don't think, for the leader of a country to look at a popular uprising and dismiss those people on the basis of them being a minority. Right? Like, that's just a minority.
Especially when people are so angry.
Absolutely. So yes, he did seem to soften on that point, but I think the overwhelming tenor of his response was hubristic vindication.
Today, the Public Order Emergency Commission stated that the very high threshold to invoke the Emergencies Act was met. Our job as a government is always to keep people safe, and invoking the Emergencies Act was the necessary thing to do to remove the threat
and to protect people. It's a measure of last resort. But the risk to personal safety, the risk to livelihoods, and equally, the risk of people losing faith in the rule of law that upholds our society and our freedoms, those risks were real.
Huh. Wait a second, dude. Wait a second. This was justified because of the risk to people's livelihoods and the risk to people losing faith in the rule of law? That's not what the inquest said at all. And that's not what the law says. There's nothing in there that you can suspend the Constitution, subvert Parliament, and suspend civil liberties, which it did, because people are losing money or because they're losing their faith in the rule of law. And he says that was an equal consideration. Not that it was a national emergency, an equal consideration. People were freaking out. What the hell's going on? How can this be the Canada that I know if this is happening in downtown Ottawa? And that was what justified doing this, which is not, that's not, no, dude, you can't do that because people are freaking out in BC that the rule of law is being threatened and they feel bad about that. And therefore you can suspend the Constitution. But that scares the shit out of me, that that's how he's interpreting this victory. That like, okay, see, I was right. You can do this if people are feeling afraid.
Yeah, I mean, what does that mean for future protests that may, you know, potentially be less hateful in nature, but that may potentially go on for days and days and days? Do those threaten the rule of law?
Well, they certainly make people feel that way.
Hmm.
People don't like this argument. People don't like slippery slope arguments because they're considered hypothetical. But, like, this is practical. This is the first time that there's been the invocation of this act, and it's the first time that there's been an inquest. And I am not surprised by, like, this is what inquests are for. It's a thing we do in Canada where something happens, and then we say, oh, well, we're going to take this very seriously and look at it. And then we look at it thoroughly, and we say, okay, that was probably okay. You know, it's sort of like peace, order, and good government. Well, you know, two out of three ain't bad, so you're good. And what that means going forward is like a few things. Like, first of all, we heard right from the Prime Minister how he's interpreting this, that, okay, here's what I think, and now I'm vindicated and validated. Here's what I think you can do. Maybe we need to change the act. Zia, like, that's going to go one of two ways. If they change the Emergency Act, it's either going to become easier to invoke it or harder. I have my suspicion about which way that's going to land.
I mean, yeah. And generally, if we're talking about governments changing policy without being specific about how they want to do it, I think that should ring some alarm bells.
I think that, like, for me, our alarm bells are just, like, deafening here, because the big issue for me throughout this process was that in order to declare a national emergency, you need to show that you're facing a national emergency. And the biggest question for me of this inquest was, like, how did you determine that this was a national emergency? You know, the thing at the Coutts border crossing had already been cleared. How did you determine that this was a national emergency? And what the government said in this inquest was, oh, trust us. Like, we had some pretty super secret information that showed us that this was a national emergency. And the commission says, all right, cool. I'll read from it. I find that this requirement is met. This was a nationwide, mobile, and constantly evolving series of events. Many provinces were affected, and the protest groups were numerous and geographically disparate. The protest in Ottawa drew protesters and convoys from across the country. The convoys were, by definition, mobile. Oh, dude, this was a national emergency because the people who were fucking up shit in downtown Ottawa came from across the nation, and because they were in trucks, which are mobile.
Yeah, they roll.
Wow. They roll. They roll. So it was a national emergency. That's the precedent now. So there's the Prime Minister who is trumpeting a huge win there. I don't know that he's a huge winner. I'll tell you who's a huge winner in this. And people are calling him a huge loser because Doug Ford was excoriated in this report for just abandoning his own province and failing to even show up for the most, like, basic level of accountability for this inquest. in the text of the report can be considered the big loser. I'm going to go the other way on that one. I think that Doug Ford pulled out a huge win because once again, he has just completely escaped scandal and scrutiny. I mean, he sat this one out, and I think it turned out to be politically exactly the right move for him. Mother to get away with it.
Another loser that was identified in this inquest were the police services in Ottawa. It was said in really certain terms that the cops failed to act. They failed to understand how serious the situation was. They failed to shut down what needed to be shut down, and the situation escalated. So I think that they need to take an L as well.
I think that there's like a whole other inquest that should happen as to what the happened with the police at all levels.
There are several police inquests that need to happen at several levels within Canadian policing institutions.
I like how we heard that, like, oh yeah, the convoy guys are like, yeah, the Mounties were giving us information every day. And then we're just like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, normal.
We're not going to dig into that?
They're besties. It's no problem. Another alarm bell for me in this was that within the inquest, they started talking about how the Canadian government did not have enough access to people's social media and how they would like to look into the idea that government should be able to monitor social media better. And again, in mm-hmm. some cases, that can be a good thing, but that to me sets off huge alarm bells as well. I could see that being abused really easily.
It goes on and on. The inquest report cites that in the 1970s, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that high levels of inflation could constitute a national emergency. Like, we are just, this is where we're coming out of this. We are lowering the bar as to like what the prime minister can do. And this isn't even like, people think I'm hyperbolic about this, but this is like, I was listening to John Ibbotson, who's like the squarest, most centrist dude from Globe and Mail, like just establishment voice, saying like, yeah, these are like quasi-dictatorial powers that Trudeau gave himself. That now we're saying high levels of inflation justify seizing that level of power. This is really serious stuff. I have like zero doubt that this is going to be hauled out for the next Indigenous blockade, the next land back protest. Like, you know, this was a freak event. These people, most of them were at their first protest ever. What we're left with is essentially a stamp of approval for government. And I have no doubt that that's going to be used in the worst ways possible. I take a little bit of comfort in the fact that this is not necessarily the end. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association released a statement. We launched a judicial review precisely because we believe that would be the best venue to test the government's claims about the legality of using the Emergencies Act. So the CCLA is taking the government to court. And I think that the standard of a court as to whether or not this was a national emergency is going to be higher than that of an inquest. So that's a lawsuit that the CCLA launched against the government. And that's going to be heard by a federal court in April. Zia, there's all kinds of news every day, and some of it goes unnoticed. We can't have that. We have to duly note it when it's worthy. This is your first time on Shortcuts. Can you duly note something for our listeners?
I certainly can. So I live in Quebec, so I decided to bring a piece of news from Quebec. Sometimes our news doesn't make it outside of the province. But I would like to talk about the fact that early in his first term, our premier, François Legault, and his Coalition Avenir Québec, which we like to call the CAQ, promised that the government would build 14,000 affordable housing units in the province. Sounds great. Now the premier is part of the way into his second term, and 9,000 of those units are still not built. Earlier this week, a coalition of housing groups in Quebec sounded the alarm at a press conference saying, you know, we're way behind on this project and our funding has started to run out. So things like inflation and rising construction costs mean that the amount of money that the CAQ originally committed to cover this project only covers about 30% of the costs, and multiple projects that are underway have to be paused because there's a lack of funding. And that's including really important projects like housing for people with disabilities in the province. The entire province is in a housing crisis. And there was a lot of fanfare when earlier last year, François Legault's government committed to sending out $500 checks to people in a certain tax bracket to help with some of their housing costs. But these sort of larger scale, longer term, much more effective projects for getting people housed are not meeting their targets, and that's not getting enough attention. So we need to get people housed, and that's not going to happen if we can't have long-term solutions. So I wanted to duly note that the government is failing to hold up their end of the bargain.
Duly noted. I got one. Listeners will remember this story that we brought you recently about how QP Briefing, this publication covering Queen's Park, the reporter Charlie Pinkerton was the person who dug into this whole Doug Ford Stag and Doe Party scandal. It became a scandal and had the story before anyone else. And QP Briefing wouldn't publish it, and Charlie Pinkerton resigned. It was the ownership of QP Briefing that blocked this story. And it was a really depressing story of, like, media publishers, for some reason, you know, assumedly protecting the, it's not much of an assumption. We know that the specific part of the story that they didn't want published was the one that implicated these developer friends of Doug Ford. And it was really sad to see publishers valuing whatever connection or protection they wanted to offer these business people over a hell of a story that people had a right to know. So Charlie Pinkerton resigned in protest, as did his editor, Jessica Smith Cross. And there were other layoffs at QP Briefing. And basically, it just, like, stopped existing over this. Like, they just didn't publish after this happened. Well, here's what I'm duly noting today. Charlie Pinkerton and Jessica Smith Cross and the rest of the gang from QP Briefing are almost immediately back at work. Not at QP Briefing, but at a new publication called Trillium, which is launched by Village Media. Village Media has scooped them up and launched a very similar publication to QP Briefing. And we don't talk about this enough, and Canada Land never talks about this. It's true, because it's a good news story, and we don't tell many of those. We will hear about shitty media bosses all the time. We will hear about media jobs disappearing. But when media jobs are created, that doesn't really get much attention. You don't hear a lot about, like, oh, good media owner sees value in great reporting team and starts a publication to platform their work and to bring their work to the public. So maybe that's worth a little bit of attention now and then. Because media boss is good, not a big story, but maybe something worth duly noting.
Duly noted.
Zia, that is Shortcuts for this week. Thank you so much for joining me for it.
Thank you.
Listen, we're on Twitter at Canada Land. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that listeners send. Zia, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter, unfortunately, at Zia Jones A.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Is Bird Note. When a bird takes wing, it leaves most of us other creatures earthbound. Birds have evolved not only wings, but many other adaptations that make it possible to fly. First of all, feathers. Feathers provide insulation, waterproofing, and a means to fly. And they're extraordinarily lightweight. Other features also help minimize the pull of gravity, mostly by reducing body weight. Birds have very light, honeycombed or hollow bones. And instead of a weighty mouthful of jawbones and teeth, birds have evolved a supremely light and serviceable beak. What birds eat also helps them stay light for flight. Most consume energy-packed foods rich in calories, like seeds, fruits, and meat. These are foods that add as little as possible to a bird's payload and deliver a lot of bang for the buck. And what birds eat is processed rapidly, so they aren't weighed down by waste. All of these adaptations for flight. And a pair of wings, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day. And you can get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram, @BirdNoteRadio.